All right, we start this week in the shortest book in the whole Old Testament, the book of Obadiah. And it's only 21 verses. It's an interesting little book. It's not. It's one of the books of the Old Testament that is never quoted in the New Testament. And it's a little unusual in that regard, but it does have something very significant in it about the history of the covenant that God made with Abraham. And it doesn't necessarily mention that in the book, but by tracing the history through how this particular book comes to pass, we can see that it reveals something about a sort of a distinction between people that God made all the way back in the book of Genesis. And this book is interesting for another reason. It's not addressed really to Israel, or, well, maybe I should correct that. It probably is written to Israel, but it's not about Israel. It's about the nation of Edom. And it's a rebuke for this particular nation. This nation of Edom, of course, is the descendants of Esau. And as a matter of fact, back in the book of Genesis, when it starts to give the genealogy of Esau, it says that Esau is Edom. It's the same person. It's just a different name for Esau. So this is a prophecy of a judgment that's going to come upon this nation. And let me say a few words of introduction about that, about the scope of the book in general, before we start tracing some of the background history, because that's really important to this book, is to understand who Esau is and how the nation that came out of him figures into the prophecy here. But this is a prophecy of judgment for one primary reason, and it's this: that when God judged his own people of Israel, the Edomites enjoyed it, and they were excited about it and rejoiced, because the children of Judah were going into punishment. And that's an interesting thing to think about, isn't it? Because Judah certainly was deserving of the punishment they received. If they weren't, God wouldn't have sent it. But it's kind of like this. If you were, if your child did something wrong, you might have to take them aside and discipline them, right? But if the other kid that they were in a fight with is standing by and laughing at the discipline, you're going to be probably more angry with him than you are with your own child, right? Because it's still your kid. You're disciplining him for his own good, but it's not a thing that you think ought to give anybody pleasure or any excitement out of it. So that's the problem he's got with the nation of Edom here, is that they were excited at the judgment that came upon Judah. And this is connected with their pride. And we're going to see that in verse 3. This nation of Edom had become a very proud nation. They were lifted up in their hearts against God. And we'll get into all the details of that later on. But for right now, let me just read the first couple of verses, and then we'll start to get back into some of the background history of this book throughout the earlier portions of the Bible. It says, "The vision of Obadiah. Thus saith the Lord God concerning Edom, we have heard a rumor from the Lord, and an ambassador is sent among the heathen. Arise ye, and let us rise up against her in battle. Behold, I have made thee small among the heathen. Thou art greatly despised." So he says that this nation of Edom, which had been at one point a fairly powerful nation in this region, he says he's going to make them small. He is going to gather people from among the heathen. That is, there are going to be Gentile nations that are going to come in and defeat Edom. That, of course, it happened more than once as time progressed, and we'll talk about that later too. But he says he's going to send them in this judgment. So who is this man Obadiah? Well, we don't really know. he's a fairly anonymous man. He is, there's no biographical detail given him about him at all, other than that he had this vision. And it's a very common name. There are about a dozen people in the Bible named Obadiah, right, that are involved in the scriptures in one way or another. The name basically means a servant of Jehovah, which opens up the possibility that this is not actually even a name at all. It's just a title that he gives himself, that this is the vision of the servant of the Lord that he writes down here. So we don't know anything about the man other than the vision he has. Then we come to the question of when did he write this? And we don't know that either, okay? The rivalry between Israel and Edom went on for so long that this is a book that could have dropped down in a number of different places and said exactly the same thing, because there was more than one time that God sent a judgment upon Judah, and the people of Edom were involved in it in some way or rejoiced in it. And then there was more than one time that Edom got judged. They got caught up in the Assyrian invasion. They got caught up in the Babylonian invasion. Later on, after the Old Testament, they're finally sort of put to rest by the Romans. So this would fit in a number of places. We're going to talk about a couple of those places in a little while as we go through some of this history. There are two primary candidates. One would be after the Babylonian captivity. And that one's sort of obvious, right? If this is a judgment on a people because they laughed or rejoiced when Judah was judged, obviously Judah was judged when they're taken into captivity in Babylon. And Edom got caught up and they received their punishment for that as well. But there's another candidate actually that I think is probably a better candidate. And that would be around the time of King Jehoram, just after Jehoshaphat, gets involved with this Queen Athaliah. We've talked about her before. We're going to talk about her more in a little bit. And that would put it back in the 840s BC, which actually would make it the oldest of all the written prophetic books, if that's the case. It's a little hard to tell. We talked, if you remember, when we first started into these minor prophets, that these books are in chronological order, sort of, almost, but not exactly, right? And we mentioned then that they're sort of in groups. There's a group that is given during the time of the divided kingdom. There's a group that are just to Judah after the northern kingdom fell. There are some that happen after the Babylonian captivity when the people come back. And the book of Obadiah is grouped with those that happened during the divided kingdom. Now, whether the people who put it in that order were around far enough back to know that was correct or not, we don't really know for sure. But it does lend some weight to an earlier date. Then on the other hand, though, if it was that, it would have been the first one in line. So we don't really know. It's a bit of a mystery about why exactly Obadiah ended up in exactly the position it is. But it doesn't really matter that much. The point of the book is still the same, no matter whether it happened in 840-something or 530-something B.C., and that is that this nation has gotten proud against God and has mocked God's people, and they're going to receive judgment for it. This is one of those prophecies in the Scripture that contains no clear promise of mercy. They have stepped over God's line, and the judgment is coming. It took quite a long time after the prophecy was given for it to finally be carried out. The nation of Edom carried on for quite a long time. But it did come about in the end. Now, I said we're going to talk some about how this is involved with the covenant of Abraham. And this is something that if you just read the book of Obadiah by itself without knowing all the background of the Old Testament, you wouldn't necessarily get a picture of how important this is. But we think back about the difference between the nation of Israel and the nation of Edom. These were always going to be rival nations because their patriarchs, their founding fathers, the people they were named for, were brothers. They were twins, actually. Yeah. And not just any twins, but there's a whole complicated story, and I know most of you know about that, but we're going to go back and look at it a little bit just to refresh memories. The idea here is this, and I want to put this forward to start with, and we'll kind of carry this through as we go through here tonight. Abraham was given the promise of the land, right? He was given that promise of the Canaan land where he was going to dwell and his descendants would have possession of that land. That promise was definitely transferred to Isaac. God made that clear in no uncertain terms, though there were other sons of Abraham. God made it clear that those other sons were not the heirs of the promise, and they didn't receive any inheritance, actually. Abraham gave them gifts and sent them away, and they were sent to another place. In other words, he took care of them, made sure that they weren't just destitute in the world, but they weren't the heirs. So Isaac quite definitely receives this promise. Now, this promise has a lot of provisions in it, and we'll kind of distill it down to something very simple. They had the promise of the land, right? That was to be their the possession of Abraham's descendants forever. That goes down to Isaac's descendants. That they had the promise also of being a blessing to all nations. So that is, the Messiah was going to come through this line. And that promise is given to Abraham and then to Isaac. Now, Isaac has these two children, Jacob and Esau. And Esau is the eldest. Though they're twins, Esau is the one that's actually born first. So by right, the promises should go down to Esau, right? Except God saw to it that it wasn't so. And what you have then is this. It must have been lodged in the mind of Esau. I don't know if it was or not. I don't know if Esau was a man of enough spiritual discernment or understanding to realize this. But if he was, I wonder if it ever crossed his mind that this land should have been my land. This promise should have been my promise. Because he had the birthright. Should have had the birthright. He was supposed to have the blessing. So if he hadn't behaved the way he did, perhaps the line of Messiah runs through Esau instead of Jacob.
Were Esau always jealous of Jacob? Was there jealous between?
Yeah, there always was, to the point that Jacob had to run for his life. And that's why he went up to Laban, up to Laban's house. And it really created the situation for him, because Jacob himself let me back up and say this. If you remember why it was that God chose Jacob rather than Esau, when we come to the book of Romans chapter 9, God made it very clear that he chose him because he chose him, because it was his will. That it wasn't because of any good that Jacob had done. It was just the sovereign will of God to make him his choice, which is a very important detail, actually. But so Jacob himself was not a spiritual all-star, right? His very name meant, well, you hear different words for it. Some people say supplanter, and some people say trickster, conniver, basically liar. That was his name. That was what they called him. He was a little liar. And so you remember the story. Let's go back there to the book of Genesis, and we'll actually look at this, because this is part of what I wanted to look at anyway. The background of these two nations, if you start back in Genesis chapter 25, this is the place where Isaac and his wife Rebekah have conceived these children. Rebekah is just about come to term. And in verse 22, Genesis 25:22, it says, "And the children struggled together within her, and she said, if it be so, why am I thus? And she went to inquire of the Lord. And the Lord said unto her," and I want you to notice what he said. He doesn't say two sons are in thy womb. He says two nations are in thy womb. Because there's a foreshadowing of what we come to all the way down in the book of Obadiah, that these two sons are not just individuals in themselves, but they're going to be nations that come out of them that struggle with each other on down through history until finally Edom is moved out of the way. And so he says, two nations are in thy womb, and two manner of people shall be separated from thy bowels, and the one people shall be stronger than the other people, and the elder shall serve the younger. And this is a thing, it's an interesting thing that God had made this pronouncement before these two children were born, that the elder shall serve the younger. And that doesn't refer actually to just Jacob and Esau. As a matter of fact, I don't think you'd find in the scripture where Esau ever did really serve Jacob. It's a reference to the nations that would come out of them. That's because that's the prophecy. It's not about the two children. It's about the two nations that would come out of them. And that prophecy, by the way, came to pass when David was king. He conquered the Edomites and he put them to tribute. And the elder did serve the younger. But she has these two children. And there's a prophecy that the elder would serve the younger. So what that tells me is that if Jacob had been a man of faith and had been patient, he wouldn't have had to pull off all the tricks he did to get the position he had, right? I said a while ago that, you know, maybe if Esau hadn't done this or that, he could have been the Messiah. I'm speaking hypothetically. That was never actually going to happen because God had already given a prophecy before they were born. And the thing was already determined. But Jacob was this person who had to take it upon himself to try to bring about the will of God. You ever meet anybody like that? They're not content just to let God to bring things about. They've got to help him. And so he wants the birthright, that special right of the firstborn. And that's a very big deal in the Old Testament days because ordinarily the eldest son would receive a double portion of the inheritance. And so, you know, if you had four sons, you'd actually divide your inheritance into five parts, and the eldest son would get two-fifths, and all the others would just get one-fifth. So you wanted to be the eldest son if you were born back then, right? It worked out good for you. But it was something even more special in this family because there was a promise at this point that would belong to the eldest alone or to the one who had the birthright alone, and that's this promise that that God had given Abraham. So, Jacob catches Esau coming. Jacob's a hunter, and he's been out in the field, and he's hungry. And Jacob catches him hungry, and Esau's coming from the field. He's faint. And verse 30 says, Esau said to Jacob, "Feed me, I pray thee, with that same red pottage, for I am faint." Therefore was his name called Edom. Edom means red. He was the pottage was red. Apparently he had red hair, so there's a lot of red in this story, right? Jacob said, "Sell me this day thy birthright." And Esau said, "Behold, I am at the point to die, and what profit shall this birthright do to me?" And Jacob said, "Swear to me this day," and he sware unto him, and he sold his birthright unto Jacob. And so Esau becomes a type of a man who has no regard for the holy things of God. In the book of Hebrews, he's called a profane person or a profane man, and that means you have no regard for holiness. And this is what he's been known as down through all of history. I don't know, he was not a very spiritually discerning man, right? Jacob, on the other hand, understands the worth of the birthright, but he doesn't trust God. They're really quite a pair, aren't they? You know, and so that's the beginning of the fight between them. And then it becomes much worse when we come to chapter 27, and that's where Isaac is about to die. And it's time for him to pass on the blessing to the eldest son, which should have been Esau's by right as the eldest. Isaac, you remember, has lost his eyesight. He can't see anymore. But he sends his son Esau out in the field to hunt, because he loved the venison that Esau would bring in. He says, "Bring me some venison, I'll give you the blessing." Well, their mother, who is not such a hero herself, is she, you know? She very clearly has a favorite child here, which is not a good way to behave, right? She loves Jacob better than Esau. And she hatches a plan to get Esau, or to get Jacob the birthright, that they're going to kill a goat, she's going to cook that and make it taste like venison. She was a good cook, I guess. She could make it taste the same, right? And they were gonna lie to Isaac and get the blessing. They knew Isaac couldn't see, so he would want to feel the son to make sure it was the right one. And Esau was hairy and Jacob was smooth. And so they put some of the goat's hide on Jacob so that when he feels, it'll feel hairy. And he just flat out steals the blessing. That's what happens, long story short. He bought the birthright, and that was bad enough, but the blessing he stole. He lied to his father, and so he has to run, right? He has to go to Laban's house. Well, his character didn't improve too much there. This is it's really quite a family. He gets up there with Laban, and you find out Laban is just about as bad as he is. They spend 20 years cheating each other.
What's the old saying? Apple don't fall too far.
Yeah, that's right. The apple doesn't fall too far from the tree. They get up there, and Jacob wants to work 7 years for a wife. And Laban pulls the old bait and switch. He works 7 years and then gives him the wrong daughter. He has to work another 7 years to get the one he wanted. And then another 6 years after that, and they're haggling back and forth about cattle and trying to cheat each other. And finally, it gets so bad that he has to run from Laban because Laban wants to kill him. And he's between the hammer and the anvil then, because the only place to run to is back where Esau was. Esau still wants to kill him. But while he's gone, there's some history that happens with Esau. And most of us who have been around church very much or have a pretty good idea of the outline of what happens with Jacob's family, right? Because that's the big part of the Bible story. Jacob eventually comes back to the promised land, and he has his sons there, and Joseph ends up going into Egypt, right? And they all have to follow him down there because of the famine. And they're down there for over 400 years. God sends Moses to deliver them from the bondage there, brings them back up to the promised land. We all know that story. But most people are less familiar with the story of Esau, because there's this whole other nation that is descended from Abraham, and so they're still part of Abraham's people, and they're still under the promise that God had made there in chapter 25, that he said there were two nations in her womb, and there's this other nation that's got to come out. So what happens with Esau's people? Well, we don't know nearly as much about them, but we do know some about them. And there's some history recorded about them. There's actually a genealogy in the scripture of some of Esau's descendants. Esau, he married two wives. Now, I should have mentioned this as we're passing through. When Jacob comes back from Laban's, the scripture teaches us there that by that time, Esau was dwelling in a place called Mount Seir. That is, he wasn't in the promised land anymore. He wasn't on Isaac's land. And that is kind of an interesting thing, by the way, because Isaac by this time has died, right? And they've left the promised land sort of unoccupied. Or they've left it to other nations that have kind of just filled in there, because Jacob's not home where he should be. He's up there at Laban's. And Esau's gone down to Mount Seir. Now, why is it that Esau ends up down at Mount Seir? Well, what Esau had done, if we turn here to chapter 36 of Genesis, it gives the generations of Esau. And it says there in verse 1, "Now these are the generations of Esau, who is Edom. Esau took his wives of the daughters of Canaan, Adah, the daughter of Elon the Hittite." She was the one he married first, and it made Rebekah so upset. That was why she wanted Jacob to go up there to Laban's to get a wife out of their own people, because she was sick of those those heathen girls down there where they were. But the second wife was Aholibamah, the daughter of Anah, the daughter of Zebaon the Hivite. And those were people who lived in the area that later becomes known as Edom. It's an area down south of the Dead Sea, really, is where it is. It's just to south and southeast of the promised land of Canaan. That's where the Edomites lived. It's mostly mountainous territory. There are some places there that are fertile and you can engage in agriculture, but it's they had a lot of mountain strongholds. We'll talk more about that later. That's one of the reasons why they thought they were so safe and secure up there, because they were in places that were difficult to attack. But the people that were up there at that time, this fellow Zibeon is a chief of those people. And so Esau marries into the, well, you wouldn't exactly call it royalty, but they didn't have kings quite yet at this time, but they had a nobility. And Esau marries into that. And that's how he comes to be up there in Mount Seir, the place that's later called Edom. It's kind of an interesting thing, because he marries in as an outsider, and his people end up ruling the whole thing before it's over with. And they end up going even by his name before it's done. He evidently was a man of some talent and ability, because he got himself in a high position there, you know. But here's the thing. We're drawing this parallel between the nation of Israel and the nation of Edom. And you think about the difference between the way these two nations come into being. Israel really comes to its existence in the promised land against all odds, doesn't it? As a matter of fact, it was miraculous. It couldn't have happened if God hadn't intervened. It was entirely an act of God. You have this people, the sons of Jacob, they're just a small nation. They end up getting themselves into slavery in Egypt, and they're under the power of the most powerful nation probably in the Middle East at that time. Well, there's no way they can get out of there, right? They'd have been there forever if God hadn't sent Moses and God hadn't sent plagues. God set them free. God works miracles to get them across the Red Sea. He works miracles. They'd have died out in the wilderness if God didn't give them manna and water. And when they finally get up to the promised land, there's no way they would have conquered those people if God hadn't given them the victory in all their battles. It's entirely a work of grace, isn't it?
Yes.
It's a fulfillment of God's promise. Now, Edom's people, he becomes a great nation in another path, and actually in the more familiar path. He does it sort of by strength of his own will and of his own ambition. I think it's probably fair to say that if you read the description of Esau and Jacob, in some ways Esau might have been the more ambitious man, the more active one, the one you'd probably less want to see leading an army against you, right? Because he was a sort of a manly man, you know. And he manages to marry into this tribe down there, and before you know it, his people are the leaders of this tribe. They're called dukes for a while, actually, in this chapter. You don't see that often in the scripture, but that seems to have been a word for sort of tribal chieftains, and that's what they were. That's what Esau's people were for a while. And they seem to come to dominate Mount Seir, this whole area, and then that becomes known as the land of the Edomites. And they actually, the exact process of it is not quite given to us, but at some point they start having kings quite a long time before Israel ever started having kings. So during the time when Israel has judges for 400 plus years, Esau's people have managed to get themselves on the throne. They've got quite a head start on David and Solomon and all those fellas, right? So now at the end of chapter 36, verse 31, it says, "These are the kings that reigned in the land of Edom before there reigned any king over the children of Israel." And it gives a whole list there down through most of the rest of the chapter about all the kings that were descended from Edom. And so this nation has become set up as a rival kingdom. You've got, if you could have looked down on this scene at the time of Jacob's death and Esau's death, most people probably would have said Esau did a lot better than Jacob did, right? Because Jacob's down there with his clan in Egypt, depending on Pharaoh. And Esau seems to have sort of taken control of a country. If you were to look at it 400 years after that, with the children of Israel down there in captivity and the nation of Edom apparently prospering, you'd think, man, Edom, they've gone the right direction. And so you see why there's probably a point in time here where, though it's hard for us to see from our perspective, that the Edomites would have thought, we're in the lead in this family rivalry, you know? We're doing pretty good up here in Edom. And then God turns the people of Israel loose from Egypt. And things start to change, right? You know the story. They spend 40 years wandering in the wilderness, but after 40 years, God starts to move things to move them toward the promised land. And in order to get there, they've got to go past the territory of the Edomites. Well, they didn't have to. If they'd gone the way they were supposed to, they could have just walked right into the promised land from the south without having to wait 40 years. But God makes them go the long way around. And they have to go through Edom. Now, I don't know, it's hard to know how much the Edomites understood or were aware of all the history of everything that came before. But can you imagine the tension that pops up here? Because probably people in Edom have some sense of the rivalry between Esau and Jacob. And they, of course, didn't have the Bible. You ever think about how the Edomites might have told the story? We have it from one point of view, but I've got an idea that when Esau passed on the story to his descendants, he probably didn't tell it exactly the same way, right? He probably had a different story. And he probably had something to say about, I mean, you assume Esau probably kept some tabs on his brother and what happened in his life. And he probably said, yeah, that Jacob, that thief that stole my blessing and bought my birthright and everything, said God took care of him. He went down to Egypt. Nobody's ever heard of him since. They disappeared, right? And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, they show up on the doorstep, say, we want to come through to go back to our land. And the people of Edom don't want anything to do with that. In Numbers chapter 20, they come up there. Moses, in verse 14, sent a messenger to the king of Edom, basically to ask for passage. And he makes a promise that just let us pass through. There was a major trade route called the King's Highway that ran up that way. And he basically says, just let us come through on the King's Highway. We won't go through your fields. We won't go through your vineyards. We won't even drink the water out of your wells. All we're asking is just let us pass through. We will not turn to the right hand nor to the left until we have passed thy borders. And that seems like a pretty fair deal. You'd think if it was family, you could at least give them a right of way to walk across your land and not take anything. Edom said unto him, thou shalt not pass by me, lest I come out against thee with a sword. And the children of Israel said unto him, we will go by the highway. And if I and my cattle drink of thy water, then I will pay for it. I will only, without doing anything else, go through on my feet. And he said, thou shalt not go through. And Edom came out against him with much people and with a strong hand, and refused to give Israel passage through his border. Wherefore Israel turned away from him. God actually wouldn't let Israel fight with the Edomites, because he had given Esau that land. And that was a promise to him. He said, that's their land and that's their family. So he just sends them the long way around. But what I'm getting at is, you see, this rivalry between these two nations didn't end with Jacob and Esau. There's some sort of eternal hatred that Esau's people had, and some sort of jealousy that never disappears. As a matter of fact, you find out in part of Israel's journey out of Egypt that the Amalekites, which were descendants of Edom, chased them down from behind and attacked the ones who were old, and they very cowardly. A very cowardly attack against the ones who were most vulnerable. And God hated them for that because they had attacked that way. The rivalry never quite disappears. And it carries on for hundreds of years. This is before they come into the promised land. You find out even after you have 400 plus years of judges, and then you've had Saul as the king, and David comes in, and David has to subdue the people. And there's an interesting story that happens in 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 14. Now Solomon has come to the throne, David's son. It says, and the Lord stirred up an adversary unto Solomon, Hadad the Edomite. He was of the king's seed in Edom. And he becomes a thorn in Solomon's side. And he's an interesting story because, well, we've mentioned before, it seems like the devil always wants to counterfeit what God does. And I think we've talked some here before about how you have Moses out there, right? The Pharaoh wanted to kill all the Hebrew children. And God preserved Moses. And that was a type, a picture of Christ. Later on, when Christ is born, Herod is going to kill all the young boys under 2 years old, and God makes provision to preserve him. This man Hadad is kind of almost the same situation in reverse. It's a really strange story. It says there in 1 Kings 11, 15, for it came to pass when David was in Edom, and Joab the captain of the host was gone up to bury the slain, after he had smitten every male in Edom, for 6 months did Joab remain there with all Israel, until he had cut off every male in Edom, right? David has gotten to the point where he's done putting up with this Edomite mess, right? He's not going to, they've been a thorn in their side for too long. He's just going to wipe them out. But it says there's this one man, Hadad, who was part of the king's seed. He was royalty in Edom. And it says there in verse 17 that Hadad fled, he and certain Edomites of his father's servants with him, to go into Egypt, Hadad being yet a little child. So Hadad there, he's just a young child, and just like Joseph and Mary fled into Egypt with Jesus, they fled into Egypt with Hadad. And he stays there for a long time. They arose out of Midian and came to Paran, and they took men with them out of Paran. They came to Egypt unto Pharaoh, king of Egypt. They gave him an house and appointed him victuals and gave him land. And Hadad found great favor in the sight of Pharaoh, so that he gave him to wife the sister of his own son, the sister of Tapenes, the queen, and the sister of Tapenes bare him Genubath, his son, whom Tapenes weaned in Pharaoh's house, and Genubath was in Pharaoh's household among the sons of Pharaoh. You've got almost shades of Joseph there too, right? He goes down there to Egypt and he prospers. The Pharaoh loves him. He becomes an important man. And he stays down there till David dies. Remember, they had to stay in Egypt in Jesus' day till Herod died. So when Herod heard in Egypt that David slept with his fathers and that Joab, the captain of the host, was dead, Hadad said to Pharaoh, "Let me depart, that I may go to mine own country." Then Pharaoh said unto him, "But what hast thou lacked with me, that, behold, thou seekest to go to thine own country?" And he answered, "Nothing, howbeit let me go in any wise." And so after he finds out David's gone, he says, "My opportunity's there, I can go back." And he does, and becomes a sort of a torment to Solomon. And apparently, through this man, God allows him to sort of resurrect the nation, right? They've almost died out. But this man is preserved. So this rivalry, this hatred still continues on generation after generation. And you find them always at war. Remember, we talked about quite a while back when we were in the book of Hosea. We talked about in Jehoshaphat's day about how Ammon and Moab and Edom tried to launch a sneak attack. They came up there in that little brook just off the Dead Sea and tried to sneak up in sort of a back way through the mountains to get at Jerusalem. And it's just war forever and ever, it seems like, with these two countries. Well, we said that there are a couple of possibilities, most prominently, about when this book of Obadiah is written and about what exact judgment it's about. And one of the best possibilities, I think, is in 2 Chronicles chapter 21. And in this chapter, Jehoshaphat was a very good king of Judah. And he had a son that was not. He had a son named Jehoram. Jehoshaphat's weakness, you remember, he was a good king himself, but he got too friendly with Ahab in the north and allowed Ahab to influence him sometimes. He made alliances with Ahab. And he ended up actually having intermarriages in his house with Ahab's house. His son Jehoram becomes the king. Jehoram's not a good man because his mother is connected with Ahab's people, right? He's mixed up with all that mess up there in the north where they brought in Baal worship and everything. And so he becomes a weak king, and the people around him realize this. Now, remember, under David, they had subdued the Edomites. But here in chapter 21 of 2 Chronicles, verse 8, it says, "In his days the Edomites revolted from under the dominion of Judah and made themselves a king. Then Jehoram went forth with his princes and all his chariots with him, and he rose up by night and smote the Edomites which compassed him in and the captain of the chariots. So the Edomites revolted from under the hand of Judah unto this day. The same time also did Libnah revolt from under his hand, because he had forsaken the Lord God of his fathers." So that's part of Jehoram's legacy as a king. He's the one that lost dominion over the Edomites after David had gone to the trouble to conquer him, and they'd been under control of Israel for quite some time. And like we said earlier, that was a fulfillment of a prophecy from God, wasn't it? That the elder would serve the younger? Well, Jehoram is such a bad king that he loses this. Now, this around this same time, there is an invasion on the nation of Israel. Up down in verse 16 of chapter 21 says, "Moreover, the Lord stirred up against Jehoram the spirit of the Philistines, and the Arabians that were near the Ethiopians, and they came up into Judah and brake into it and carried away all the substance that was found in the king's house and his sons also and his wives, so that there was never a son left him save Jehoahaz, the youngest of his sons. They were able, actually, Jehoram had gotten so weak that they were able to launch an invasion against Israel or against Judah and enter into the king's house and steal Jehoram's possessions and so on. And that very well may be what it was that the Edomites were rejoicing in. We'll see later on in Obadiah that they were rejoicing because God had allowed judgment on the people. This may be exactly what it was about, because there's sort of a connection here, right? The Edomites get their independence. They're able to throw off the yoke of control from Judah. And at the same time, this judgment comes from God on Judah. You can imagine the attitude they probably had in Edom, right? You know, they're probably thrilled to death to see the Judeans getting judged by God. Well, Jehoram doesn't last a whole lot longer. God gave him an incurable disease. And verse 18 said, after all this, the Lord smote him in his bowels with an incurable disease. And it came to pass that in process of time, after the end of 2 years, his bowels fell out by reason of his sickness. So he died of sore diseases. And his people made no burning for him like the burning of his fathers. They didn't mourn his death at all, it doesn't seem. And so he's moved off the scene now. His son is Ahaziah. And he becomes king now. And we've talked some about Ahaziah before. He's come into another story as we've studied the minor prophets. We talked about him in the book of Hosea, because he was the one when God sent Jehu to bring judgment on the house of Ahab in the north, and he went to kill the king in the north. Ahaziah was the man he killed who was actually a son of David, and he kind of got caught up as collateral damage in the thing. And if you remember the story, after Ahaziah was killed, Athaliah, his mother, who was a queen because she'd married in, she was actually of Ahab's people. She was a worshiper of idols, a worshiper of Baal, who was connected with Jezebel and all that crew up there. She decides to wipe out all the royal seed so she can just rule as king. Now, this raises the very interesting possibility that Obadiah gives his prophecy during the reign of Athaliah, which is kind of an interesting thing to think about, isn't it? You know, you have one of the really wicked rebels in all the Bible who's in the southern kingdom. She was really the only person who ever came to rule for a while who wasn't descended from David, who wasn't a rightful descendant of David there, until they went into captivity in Babylon. And it'd be interesting, wouldn't it, if you had at that moment when you have all this mess and turmoil in Judah, and if you'd been living in Judah at that time, it would have been a pretty miserable time, I think, because she was a dreadful ruler, and it wouldn't have been any fun at all to have her as a queen. And can't you just imagine some of those people down there in Edom in the middle of all this rejoicing, because now they've got their independence, and it would appear that they've just about run out of gas in the kingdom of Israel, in the kingdom of Judah. And so this is a pretty good candidate for the time of when Obadiah would have been written. Does God have things to say to Judah at this time? Sure he does. But he's got something to say to Obadiah, to the Edomites too, through Obadiah. So that's one good possibility for when this book is written. The other one, of course, and this is the one that is a lot of people latch onto as more obvious, again, would be after they come out of captivity out of Babylon, because it's clear they've been under judgment at that time. But there are certain details in the book of Obadiah, and we'll look at this as we go through, that I tend to lean toward the earlier date, actually. Anyway, let's look here at just the first two or three verses of Obadiah before we quit for tonight. Verse 1 says, the vision of Obadiah, thus saith the Lord God concerning Edom, we have heard a rumor from the Lord, and an ambassador is sent among the heathen. Arise ye, and let us rise up against her in battle. Behold, I have made thee small among the heathen. Thou art greatly despised. When it says he sent a rumor, that means a report or that it's sort of something sort of been floating on the breeze, right? God has the ability to control all kingdoms of this earth, whether the kings know it or not. He runs this world the way he wants to, and he can influence world leaders anytime he wants to. He can bring history about any way he wants to. And this nation of Edom has mocked God's people. At the time this is going on, God already has great nations stirred up ready to invade this area. They're probably not thinking much about Edom because Edom is not that important at this time. They've got other things in view. Nations like Edom, and for that matter, probably even Israel at this time in Judah, don't really register that much on the radars of nations like Egypt and Babylon and Assyria. They're not great powers. All these little nations are sort of pawns in their game, just like we've seen in the 20th century with the conflict between the United States and the Soviet Union and how many small countries there were that got caught up in that neither the Soviet Union or the United States were primarily concerned about, but they just became pawns in the game. And I think that's probably what Israel and Edom, for that matter, would have been at this time. I don't think, like I said earlier, that in the various judgments that God brought upon Israel, Edom tended to get caught up in them. When the Assyrians came down, they eventually got to Edom. When the Babylonians came to invade the southern kingdom, they eventually got to Edom. Later on, after the Old Testament is over, once the Romans come down, they eventually sort of wipe out Edom, and that's prophesied at the end of this book. There's a prophecy of what Rome would do to Edom. I doubt if any of those nations went into that part of the earth looking for Edom, right? That's not why they're there. Assyria comes through there trying to get to Egypt. Babylon comes through trying to get to Egypt. And Rome probably as well is looking for all of them are more concerned with that area really as a land route from northern Africa up into the north. And they don't really care much about this nation. But God is running history in a way that we don't understand. Sometimes the events that happen on the world stage that we think are most important are not really what's most important. I've maintained for quite a long time that the major thing that happened in World War I and World War II was to put the land of Israel back in the hands of the Jewish people. There were a lot of other things that happened, and there were a lot of other things that history regards as a much bigger deal than that. But that is one thing that happened, and it's probably more important on God's calendar than anything else that happened in those wars. Well, that's what God says. He sent an ambassador among the heathen, that is the Gentile people. He says, "Arise ye and let us rise up against her in battle." God stirred up these Assyrians and Babylonians and Romans to come fulfill his will. And he says, "Behold, I have made thee small among the heathen. Thou art greatly despised." Now, I'm not going to go, on into verse 3 too much tonight. We'll talk about that next time because it really connects more with the next section. But they have gotten very proud up there in Edom, and they're an interesting case, and I think not that unusual in the history of the world. And not even just among nations, but among individuals. Have you ever known somebody that was really, really proud of themselves and everybody else just despised them? Yeah. Right? Everybody, you know, what's the old expression? I'd like to buy him for what he's worth and sell him for what he thinks he's worth, you know? And that seems to be the case of Edom. They had a history. There was a period of time when they were a major power in that region. That's long past. And Assyria and Babylon and Rome and all those other nations are not scared of Edom. They don't worry about Edom anymore. They're despised, he says. You know what they thought about the Edomites? They're a bunch of hillbillies hiding in their caves up there in the mountains. That's what they thought. They thought they were backward people. And that's not entirely an unfair assessment. That didn't have that much contact with the outside world. They didn't have a lot of trade. And they just sort of settled up there in the mountains. And he says, you think this is the idea. You think you're a big deal, but you're not. And you're about to find that out. That's the judgment that's coming upon you. And we'll stop there. We won't go any further with that tonight. Next time, Lord willing, we'll pick up in verse 3. And we'll talk about this pride they had, the place where they dwelt. They really did have a great stronghold. They had possession at the time of the place that's now called Petra. And you've probably seen pictures of Petra. It's very, they weren't the ones, I don't think, who made all the carvings there that you see nowadays, but it is a place that's very difficult to attack. There's a, into the city of Petra, there's a, you have to go down through a sort of a canyon that's, I think, close to 2 miles long, and some places is 600 or 700 feet tall on each side. And there are places where it's no more than 10 or 15 feet wide, and it becomes very easy to defend because you can't send a, an army down there in great force. They thought they were secure there, but it turns out there's no place you can be secure from the wrath of God, and that's what they're about to find out.